So we're here today with Josh Douglas, professor of law at the University of Kentucky, focusing especially on election law. Mr. Douglas, welcome to State of Kentucky.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
So I heard you speak the other night in Frankfurt about your new book. I would like for you to tell us about the book first so we can get that right up front and people can go purchase it if they are interested. So what is the name of the book and what is it about?
Sure. So the book, I've got it right here. It's called The Court Versus the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. And it's basically an unfortunate tale of how the U.S. Supreme Court has failed to adequately protect the constitutional right to vote. Now, it's just a book of stories. I wrote it specifically for non-lawyers. Actually some of the best feedback and the feedback I've had that I'm most proud of is that people find it really accessible. It's a bunch of stories about people who are engaged in some of the most important voting rights cases over the past 50 years. You'll encounter the people behind the Citizens United case about campaign finance, Bush v. Gore that ended the 2000 presidential election, but also some cases that no one's heard of, but have had a really important impact on the way the court has failed to protect the right to vote. And it's not just recently, but it's really been over the past 50 years. So I chronicle some cases from the 1980s, 1990s. I tell the stories of the fascinating people behind those cases. And in doing so, weave through a narrative about how, unfortunately, voters are not the paramount interest in the protection that the Supreme Court has granted.
So you laid this out very clearly the other night, the various ways that the Supreme Court has flipped the balance, as it were, through these various cases. Can you lay out those steps or those stages of the changes?
Yeah. So in the 1960s, which was the high water mark for the court's protection of the right to vote, the court applied what lawyers call strict scrutiny. And that basically means that anytime a law impacting the voting process was challenged, the state had to explain why it had a really, really good reason for the law, and also, you know, why the law achieved its goals. Essentially, there had to be a really close fit between what the state was trying to do, and it had to be legitimate in what the state was trying to do, and what the law actually accomplished. And so really, you know, voters would provide evidence that a particular voting process or a rule, say, like in Virginia, where they used to impose a poll tax, where you had to pay a small fee to get on the registration list. And the state of Virginia had to explain why it had that law, what the reason and purpose for it was, and why the law would achieve the state's goals. And of course, the court struck that down and said that the ability to pay a poll tax should have no bearing on one's eligibility to vote. But then in the series of cases that I discuss in the book from the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, the court begins to pull back from this strong judicial protection of voting rights. Instead of saying, you know, state, we're going to put you to the test and you have the obligation of basically justifying with a really strong justification your voting rule, instead, the court started to say, well, we're going to balance the interest that the state says it has with the burden on voters. And then that started to more even more and more into basically, well, state, we're just going to trust you. So now voters have to provide a lot of evidence to show why a law is disenfranchising, while the state really doesn't have to say anything besides, well, this is just how we want to run our election, or we're concerned about fraud and this law has, you know, some minimal bearing to improving the integrity of the election. So it's what I refer to as undue deference to state politicians in voting rules. And these are the very people we should trust the least to come up with the most fair rules for running an election.
I was intrigued with the fact that you likened the gerrymandering situation to the first district, and you talked about how you could put those two together, the gerrymander map. But you went on to say that there were some remedies that we could use for this change in the court approach? What are some of the things we could do to undo or fight back against some of these changes the courts have made?
Yeah, so I think first you're referring to the Kentucky Congressional District, the first district, which the shape of it looks eerily similar to that very first political cartoon of a salamander on top of the map of Massachusetts. And this is the inspiration for the term gerrymandering. It was the then governor of Massachusetts, Eldridge Gerry, he pronounced his name Gerry, G-E-R-R-Y, and the salamander of the shape of one of the districts in Massachusetts. And there's a political cartoon that called it the Gerrymander or gerrymander. And that's how we have the name gerrymandering. And again, if you take the Kentucky map, the first congressional district, and just turn it 90 degrees and hold it up next to that political cartoon of the initial gerrymander, they look kind of eerily similar. It's really interesting. But your question was about the remedies. And I think there are a few things we can do. One is that we can hope that state courts will robustly construe their state constitutions, as they should, because state constitutions say more explicitly that there's a protection for voters, that elections must be free and or free and equal. And so there's actually textually more protection for the electorate under state constitutions. And there have been some successes where state courts have struck down gerrymanders under the state constitution, places like Pennsylvania, North Carolina, before the North Carolina Supreme Court had a change composition and then reversed itself. And I was hopeful that the Kentucky Supreme Court would follow through. Unfortunately, in my view, the court, you know, really narrowly read the state constitution. The court actually said the Kentucky state constitution prohibits gerrymandering, but then said that this map was not an egregious enough example of it. And I sort of befuddled as to if this map is not bad enough, what would be to satisfy the court standard that the state constitution prohibits gerrymandering. But, you know, in the states where the state courts are willing to properly read their state constitutions, litigation is a good path. But there's also the idea of independent redistricting commissions, where instead of having the politicians draw the map, you have an independent body that's fairly selected, that has representatives of all sides, that can take on the task. And we've seen this in places like Michigan, Arizona, and so both so-called red, so-called blue, so-called purple states, to great success to create maps that are more fair. I mean, you're not going to take politics entirely out of the process, but you can minimize politics by having an independent commission. Here in Kentucky, we would need the legislature itself to allow the ballot initiative for a commission. So the harder argument to ask the legislature to basically give up its own power to draw its own districts and thereby choose its own constituents.
Yeah, I can see some of these things happening and they have happened in other states. I agree with you that doing them in Kentucky might be difficult, but the deference part is really fascinating to me, that the court sort of decided over time that it was going to give more deference to the states and to the state governments and less to the voters. You came up with a 4-part test for how to improve our voting situation. And I believe it was called the bipartisan fairness approach or something like that.
Or the Grand Election Compromise is what I call
Grand
it.
Election Compromise. I should have remembered that. That's a great name. So tell us about the Grand Election Compromise.
Sure. So, and this, I talk about this in the conclusion to this book here. It's basically a way that we can start having better conversations about the kinds of voting rules that we should adopt, and even potentially a way for courts to analyze election laws. So there's 4 principles of the Grand Election Compromise. And my argument is basically that everyone should agree on these. They're at a high level of generality that I think they should be seen as uncontroversial. And if they're not, I start to question, people don't agree with them, then I start to question, are we having the same kind of conversation about democracy? And the idea here is that not only should they be the start of a conversation, but also that if a proposed voting rule doesn't achieve at least one of them and violates any of them, then we should reject it. So what are they? The four principles of the Grand Election Compromise are that voters should have easy access to the ballot. And Bruce, I think you and I talked about that encompasses fair representation as well. So voters should have easy access to the ballot with fair representation. The election system should be set up to deter fraud or to make sure that it's secure. That's the second one. The third one is that voters should be well educated. And fourth, the losing candidates should graciously accept defeat. And so any law that we think about, we should ask, does it achieve at least one of the goals and hopefully more than one of the goals? And does it not violate any? So if the law is one that will violate the idea of easy access to the ballot, then we should reject it. If the law is, you know, somehow going to make fraud more easy, make it easier for fraud to occur, then we should reject it. But importantly, I think there are rules that can achieve multiple goals. So, you know, take here in Kentucky, where we used to have 0 days of early voting, and now we have three. Now, I'd like more. I don't think three is enough, but three is better than zero. And that's obviously a measure to make it easier for people to vote, right? We've given them three additional days to go to the polls. But that's also a security measure kind of in disguise. Why? Well, if you're concerned about things happening at the polls, you want better oversight over the election process. And if you have a really long line and trying to process voters quickly and voters getting frustrated, you might open the door to less oversight. Now, I still think there's very, very minimal fraud that occurs. But what, you know, better way than to watch it more closely than if we have voting spread out over more days where we can watch more carefully. So something like early voting is actually both an access measure and a security measure. Same thing goes with the online portal to request an absentee ballot. You obviously have easier access to the ballot, but you can also track ballots through a barcode like you do with packages as they go through the system. So it's kind of an integrity measure as well. So in this way, I think we can get to better voting rules. Now, Kentucky doesn't have the model in terms of voting rules with respect to like our voter registration deadline of 29 days before the election is way too long. Like I said, we only have 3 days of early voting, only hours on election day are 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. But we do have measures that we've passed in recent years that have had bipartisan support because I think they adhere to what I refer to as this grand election compromise.
So when did the book come out?
It's past May, May 14th. When we're talking now, it's maybe 5 weeks old or so.
Okay. So, but you've been known for talking about voting and elections and election law for a long time here in the state. And I know you get asked questions a lot and you appear in committees and so on and so forth in Frankfurt. Your book came out after the General Assembly adjourned. Have you spoken to any of the legislators or have they approached you about any of the ideas in the book? And if not, are you planning on doing it in the fall or once the General Assembly starts back?
Well, first off, I'll talk to anyone who wants to talk to me about the book. I mean, the goal here is, especially because I wrote it for the general public, for voters to reach a wide audience. My first book, which came out in 2019, was called Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. And one of the things I'm most proud of about that book is that the one of the reasons we have vote centers now in Kentucky, where instead of having to go to your home-based precinct, you can go to any vote center in the county and they're all connected. Well, that idea came from my 2019 book. And Secretary of State Michael Adams read the book and he said, you know, he agreed with a lot of the things in it, but disagreed with some things. But, you know, could we work together on the things he agreed with? And he had not heard of vote centers that had taken place in other states and he wanted to learn more. And, you know, we initially adopted them just for the pandemic election of 2020, but now it's permanent part of Kentucky law that counties can move to vote centers. And we're doing more and more of that, not only in early voting, but on election day as well, depending on the county. So, you know, people have asked me if the first book was a success and, it, you know, the question often is, did it sell a lot of copies? And of course I want people to read the book, but you know, having a real world impact on our state is something I'm really proud of. For the second book, you know, the book is maybe a little more negative in terms of the way in which the Supreme Court has harmed voting rights. I'm certainly open to conversations with any member of the General Assembly or you know, the Secretary. And I have talked to Secretary of State Michael Adams about the book, and I think he's gained some interesting insights. And, you know, some people are going to say that, you know, I'm just criticizing cases I disagree with. I reject that assertion, because what I'm doing is criticizing the entire approach to how the court has. And in fact, there are some decisions in here where I probably agree with the ultimate result, but not with the way the court got there. And the way the court got there is really important and really concerning. So it's not just about cases that I don't like the outcome. So I've had conversations with him, and certainly, I mean, I have not had conversations with other members, with members of the General Assembly, but certainly open to anyone who's interested in kind of learning how we got to this point. Now, of course, members of the General Assembly probably like the fact that the court's deferring to them so much, right? Because they can pass whatever rules they want and not have much judicial oversight. But I think they should still be aware of the harms that creates for overall democratic processes.
Well, let me ask you the magic wand question. So let's suppose that rather than having to go through the legislature or the Secretary of State, that you could just wave a magic wand and make changes to the way we hold elections in Kentucky. What are two or three things that you would change if you had that power?
I would adopt same-day voter registration, which is being implemented already in over half of the states to great success. excuse me, there's, you know, no, you know, instances of fraud or other problems. And we know that the states with the highest turnout have same day voter registration. And then the second big thing is that I would take away the requirement that you need to provide an excuse to vote by mail for absentee voting. Again, we're in the minority of states. About two thirds of the states have adopted universal vote by mail, where you can simply request your ballot without an excuse. You know, we did this for the pandemic. It was not used a ton, but it's the sort of thing that in other states you see it takes several cycles for the state to the state's voters to kind of get used to it. So, I think if you just look at one election when we've used this, that's not a good measure of the likelihood that it would be successful in the future. So those are two things. But I will say that, you know, even early voting, there's been attacks on the 3 days of early voting we have. And, you know, the Secretary of State has made, I think, the very smart argument that if people like early voting, they need to use it, because the lower the numbers of early voting, the, you know, easier it is for those who might oppose it to have, you know, arguments against it. So we need to at least have strong early voting numbers. But, you asked for two or three. The two I would adopt would be same day registration and universal vote by mail.
I'm interested in the fact that after your talk the other night, I spoke to the county clerk in Fayette County, I believe it was. No, in Frankfort. Right. And he talked about the fact that the mail-in ballots have barcodes, and they track the ballot from the moment it's sent out till it comes back, till it's the whole nine yards. He said, I don't know how anybody could rig this system. It's just pretty much, you know, as safe as we can make it. I think the arguments against vote by mail that it encourages fraud are just so specious.
Absolutely. And you hear these anecdotes of, oh, you know, my brother's cousin's uncle's mother heard about someone, and, you know, or you get, you know, occasional isolated instances. Like there was a congressional election in North Carolina that had to be redone because of fraud in it. But guess what? We caught it, right? The system worked because we caught that. Now, people will say, well, what about the ones you don't catch? It makes me think about, you know, when my kids were younger and they'd say, Daddy, there's a monster under the bed. No matter how many times I checked and told them there was no monster, it's hard to convince them. And that's sort of what we have to do is prove a negative. The fraud that's out there, we catch. The fraud that we don't catch is not out there. It doesn't exist. At least it's to any measurable degree.
Josh Douglas, hold up your book one more time so we can all see it here. This is The Court Versus the Voters by Josh Douglas of the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much for being with us. I will put a link to the book below on the YouTube video and in our podcast notes. And I hope lots of people buy it. I already have. I've already started reading it. So thank you again for your work on this. And I do hope that you get to wave some of that magic wand come the next General Assembly.
I appreciate that, Bruce. Thanks so much.